Chapter 5. They had to fill the hole back up, of course, and besides, he had the horse. But even then, it was a good while until daylight when he left High Boy with Alexander at the pasture gate and tried, remembered, to tiptoe into the house. But at once, his mother, her hair loose and in her nightdress, wailed from right beside the front door, "Where have you been?" Then followed him to his uncle's door, and then while his uncle was putting some clothes on, "You? Digging up a grave?" And he with a sort of weary, indefatigable patience, just about worn out himself now from riding and digging, then turning around and undigging, and then riding again, somehow managing to stay that one jump ahead of what he had really never hoped to beat anyway. Alexander and Miss Habersham helped, which, if anything, seemed to be worse, though she was still not loud. Just amazed and inexpugnable until his uncle came out fully dressed, even to his necktie, but not shaved, and said, "Now, Maggie, do you want to wake Charlie?" Then following them back to the front door, and this time she said, and he thought again how you could never really beat them because of their fluidity, which was not just a capacity for mobility, but a willingness to abandon with the substanceless promptitude of wind or air itself, not only position, but principle too. You didn't have to marshal your forces because you already had them. Superior artillery, weight, right justice and precedent and usage and everything else, and made your attack and cleared the field, swept all before you. Or so you thought until you discovered that the enemy had not retreated at all, but had already abandoned the field, and did not merely abandon the field, but had usurped your very battle cry in the process. You believed you had captured a citadel and instead found you had merely entered an untenable position and then found the unimpaired and even unmarked battle set up again in your unprotected and unsuspecting rear. She said, "But he's got to sleep. He hasn't even been to bed." So that he actually stopped until his uncle said, hissed at him, "Come on. What's the matter with you? Don't you know she's tougher than you and me both, just as old Habersham was tougher than you and Alexander put together? You might have gone out there without her to drag you by the hand, but Alexander wouldn't, and I'm still not so sure you would when you came right down to it." So he moved on too beside his uncle toward where Miss Habersham sat in the truck behind his uncle's parked car. It had been in the garage at 9 o'clock last night. Later, when he had time, he would remember to ask his uncle just where his mother had sent him to look for him. "I take that back," his uncle said. "Forget it. Out of the mouths of babes and sucklings and old ladies," he paraphrased. "Quite true, as a lot of truth often is, only a man just don't like to have it flung in his teeth at 3 o'clock in the morning. And don't even forget your mother, which, of course, you can't. She has already long since seen to that. Just remember that they can stand anything, accept any fact. It's only men who burk at facts, provided they don't have to face it. Can assimilate it with their heads turned away and one hand extended behind them as the politician accepts the bribe. Look at her, who will spend a long, contented, happy life never abating one jot of her refusal to forgive you for being able to button your own pants." And still a good while until daylight when his uncle stopped the car at the sheriff's gate and led the way up the short walk and onto the rented gallery. Since he couldn't succeed himself, although now in his third term the elapsed time covering Sheriff Hampton's tenure was actually almost twice as long as the 12 years of his service. He was a countryman, a farmer and son of farmers when he was first elected, and now owned himself the farm and house where he had been born, living in the rented one in town during his term of office, then returning to the farm which was his actual home at each expiration, to live there until he could run for and be elected sheriff again. "I hope he's not a heavy sleeper," Miss Habersham said. "He ain't asleep," his uncle said. He's cooking breakfast. Cooking breakfast, Miss Habersham said. And then he knew that, for all her flat back and the hat which had never shifted from the exact top of her head, as though she kept it balanced there not by any pins, but simply by the rigid, unflagging poise of her neck, as Negro women carry a whole family wash, she was about worn out with strain and lack of sleep, too. He's a countryman, his uncle said. Any food he eats after daylight in the morning is dinner. Mrs. Hampton's in Memphis with their daughter waiting for the baby, and the only woman who will cook a man's breakfast at 3:30 a.m. is his wife. No hired town cook's going to do it. She comes at a decent hour, about 8 o'clock, and washes the dishes. His uncle didn't knock. He started to open the door, then stopped and looked back past both of them to where Alexander stood at the bottom of the front steps. "And don't you think you're going to get out of it just because your mama don't vote," he told Alexander. "You come on, too." Then his uncle opened the door, and at once they smelled the coffee and the frying hog meat, walking on linoleum toward a faint light at the rear of the hall, then across a linoleum-floored dining room in rented Grand Rapids Mission into the kitchen, into the hard, cheerful blast of a wood stove where the sheriff stood over a sputtering skillet in his undershirt and pants and socks, his braces dangling and his hair mussed and tousled with sleep like that of a 10-year-old boy, a batter cake turner in one hand and a cup towel in the other. The sheriff had already turned his vast face toward the door before they entered it, and he watched the little, hard, pale eyes flick from his uncle to Miss Habersham to himself, and then to Alexander. And even then it was not the eyes which widened so much for that second, but rather the little, hard, black pupils which had tightened in that one flick to pinpoints. But the sheriff said nothing yet, just looking at his uncle now, and now even the little hard pupils seemed to expand again, as when an expulsion of breath untightens the chest. And while the three of them stood quietly and steadily watching the sheriff, his uncle told it, rapid and condensed and succinct, from the moment in the jail last night when his uncle had realized that Lucas had started to tell, or rather ask him something, to the one when he had entered his uncle's room 10 minutes ago and waked him up, and stopped, and again they watched the little hard eyes go flick, flick, slick across their three faces, then back to his uncle again, staring at his uncle for almost a quarter of a minute without even blinking. Then the sheriff said, "You wouldn't come here at 4 o'clock in the morning with a tale like that if it wasn't so." "You ain't listening just to 2 16-year-old children," his uncle said. "I remind you that Miss Habersham was there." "You don't have to," the sheriff said. "I haven't forgot it. I don't think I ever will." Then the sheriff turned. A gigantic man, and in the 50s, too. You wouldn't think he could move fast, and he didn't really seem to, yet he had taken another skillet from a nail in the wall behind the stove and was already turning toward the table, where, for the first time he noticed, saw the side of smoked meat, before he seemed to have moved at all, picking up a butcher knife from beside the meat before his uncle could even begin to speak. "Have we got time for that? You've got to drive 60 miles to Harrisburg, to the district attorney. You'll have to take Miss Habersham and these boys with you for witnesses to try and persuade him to originate a petition for the exhumation of Vincent Gowrie's body." The sheriff wiped the handle of the knife rapidly with the cup towel. "I thought you told me Vincent Gowrie ain't in that grave." "Officially he is," his uncle said. "By the county records he is. And if you, living right here and knowing Miss Habersham and me all your political life, had to ask me twice, what do you think Jim Halliday is going to do? Then you've got to drive 60 miles back here with your witnesses and the petition and get Judge Maycox to issue an order." The sheriff dropped the cup towel onto the table. "Have I?" he said mildly, almost inattentively, so that his uncle stopped perfectly still watching him as the sheriff turned from the table, the knife in his hand. Oh, his uncle said. I've thought of something else, too, the sheriff said. I'm surprised you ain't. Or maybe you have. His uncle stared at the sheriff. Then Alexander. He was behind them all, not yet quite through the dining room door into the kitchen, said in a voice as mild and impersonal as though he were reading off a slogan catchphrase advertising some object he didn't own and never expected to want. It might not have been a mule. It might have been a horse. Maybe you've thought of it now, the sheriff said. Oh, his uncle said. He said, yes. But Miss Habersham was already talking. She had given Alexander one quick, hard look, but now she was looking at the sheriff again as quick and as hard. So do I, she said. And I think we deserve better than secrecy. I do too, Miss Eunice, the sheriff said. Except that the one that needs considering right now ain't in this room. Oh, Miss Habersham said. She said yes, too. She said, of course, already moving, meeting the sheriff halfway between the table and the door and taking the knife from him and going on to the table when he passed her and came on toward the door. His uncle, then he, then Alexander moving out of the way as the sheriff went on into the dining room and across it into the dark hall, shutting the door behind him. And then he was wondering why the sheriff hadn't finished dressing when he got up. A man who didn't mind, or had to, or anyway did get up at 3:30 in the morning to cook himself some breakfast, would hardly mind getting up 5 minutes earlier and have time to put his shirt and shoes on, too. Then Miss Habersham spoke, and he remembered her. A lady's presence, of course, was why he had gone to put on the shirt and shoes, without even waiting to eat the breakfast. And Miss Habersham spoke. And he jerked, without moving, heaved up out of sleep, having been asleep for seconds, maybe even minutes on his feet, as a horse sleeps. But Miss Habersham was still only turning the side of meat onto its edge to cut the first slice. She said, can't he telephone to Harrisburg and have the district attorney telephone back to Judge Maycox? That's what he doing now, Alexander said. Telephone him. Maybe you'd better go to the hall where you can overhear good what he's saying, his uncle told Alexander. Then his uncle looked at Miss Habersham again. He, too, watched her slicing rapid slice after slice of the bacon as fast and even almost as a machine could have done it. Mr. Hampton says we won't need any papers. We can attend to it ourselves without bothering Judge Maycox. Miss Habersham released the knife. She didn't lay it down. She just opened her hand and in the same motion picked up the cup towel and was wiping her hands as she turned from the table, crossing the kitchen toward them faster, a good deal faster than even the sheriff had moved. Then what are we wasting time here for, she said. For him to put on his necktie and coat? His uncle stepped quickly in front of her. We can't do anything in the dark, he said. We must wait for daylight. We didn't, Miss Habersham said. Then she stopped. It was either that or walk over his uncle, though his uncle didn't touch her, just standing between her and the door until she had to stop at least for the second for his uncle to get out of the way. And he looked at her, too, straight, thin, almost shapeless in the straight cotton dress beneath the round exactitude of the hat, and he thought, she's too old for this. And then corrected it. No, a woman, a lady, shouldn't have to do this. And then remembered last night when he had left the office and walked across the backyard and whistled for Alexander, and he knew he had believed, and he still believed it, that he would have gone alone even if Alexander had stuck to his refusal. But it was only after Miss Habersham came around the house and spoke to him that he knew he was going to go through with it. And he remembered again what old Ephraim had told him after they found the ring under the hog trough. If you got something outside the common run that's got to be done and can't wait, don't waste your time on the men folks. They works on what your uncle calls the rules and the cases. Get the women's and the children at it. They works on the circumstances. Then the hall door opened. He heard the sheriff cross the dining room to the kitchen door. But the sheriff didn't enter the kitchen, stopping in the door, standing in it even after Miss Habersham said in a harsh, almost savage voice, "Well?" And he hadn't put on his shoes, nor even picked up the dangling gallows, and he didn't seem to have heard Miss Habersham at all. Just standing, looming, bulging in the door, looking at Miss Habersham. Not at the hat, not at her eyes, nor even her face, just at her. As you might look at a string of letters in Russian or Chinese which someone you believed had just told you spelled your name, saying at last in a musing, baffled voice, "No." Then turning his head to look at him and saying, "It ain't you neither." Then turning his head further until he was looking at Alexander, while Alexander slid his eyes up at the sheriff, then slid them away again, then slid them up again. "You," the sheriff said. "You're the one. You went out there in the dark and helped dig up a dead man. Not only that, a dead white man that the rest of the white folks claimed another nigger had murdered. Why? Was it because Miss Habersham made you?" "Never nobody made me," Alexander said. "I didn't even know I was gone. I had done already told Chick I didn't aim to. Only when we got to the truck, everybody seemed to just take it for granted I wasn't going to do nothing else but go, and before I knowed it, I wasn't." "Mr. Hampton," Miss Habersham said. Now the sheriff looked at her. He even heard her now. "Haven't you finished slicing that meat yet?" he said. "Give me the knife, then." He took her by the arm, turning her back to the table. "Ain't you done enough rushing and stewing around tonight to last you a while? It'll be daylight in 15 minutes, and folks don't start lynchings in daylight. They might finish one by daylight if they had a little trouble or bad luck and got behind with it. But they don't start them by daylight because then they would have to see one another's faces. How many can eat more than 2 eggs? They left Alexander with his breakfast at the kitchen table and carried theirs into the dining room, he and his uncle and Miss Habersham carrying the platter of fried eggs and meat and the pan of biscuits baked last night and warmed again in the oven until they were almost like toast, and the coffee pot in which the unstrained grounds and the water had been boiling together until the sheriff had thought to remove the pot from the hot part of the stove. 4 of them, although the sheriff had set 5 places, and they had barely sat down when the sheriff raised his head, listening, though he himself heard nothing, then rose and went into the dark hall and toward the rear of the house. And then he heard the sound of the back door, and presently the sheriff came back with Will Leggett, though minus the shotgun, and he turned his head enough to look out the window behind him, and sure enough, it was daylight. The sheriff served the plates while his uncle and Leggett passed theirs and the sheriff's cup to Miss Habersham at the coffee pot. Then at once he seemed to have been hearing for a long time the sheriff from a great distance saying, "Boy, boy." Then, "Wake him up, Gavin. Let him eat his breakfast before he goes to sleep." And he jerked. It was still only daylight. Miss Habersham was still pouring coffee into the same cup, and he began to eat, chewing and even swallowing, rising and falling as though to the motion of the chewing along the deep, soft, bottomless mire of sleep, into, then out of the voices buzzing of old, finished things no longer concern of his, the sheriff's. "Do you know Jake Montgomery from over in Crossman County? Been in and out of town here for the last 6 months or so?" Then Leggett's. "Sure. A kind of jack-leg timber buyer now. Used to run a place he called a restaurant just across the Tennessee line out of Memphis, though I never heard of nobody trying to buy nothing that had to be chewed in it, until a man went and got killed in it one night 2-3 years ago. They never did know just how much Jake did or didn't have to do with it, but the Tennessee police run him back across the Mississippi line just on principle. Since then, I reckon he's been laying around his pa's farm over beyond Glasgow. Maybe he's waiting until he figures folks have forgot about that other business and he can set up again in another place on a highway with a hole under the floor big enough to hide a case of whiskey in. What was he doing around here? The sheriff said. Then Leggett, buying timber, ain't he? Ain't him and Vincent Gowrie? Then Leggett said with the barest inflection, was? And then with no inflection at all, what is he doing? And he, this time, his own voice indifferent along the soft, deep edge of sleep, too indifferent to bother if it were allowed or not, he ain't doing anything now. But it was better afterward. Out of the stale, warm house again into the air, the morning, the sun in one soft, high, level, golden wash in the highest tips of the trees, gliding the motionless, obese uprush of the town water tank in spider-legged elongate against the blue. The four of them in his uncle's car once more, while the sheriff stood, leaned above the driver's window, dressed now even to a bright orange and yellow necktie, saying to his uncle, you run Miss Eunice home so she can get some sleep. I'll pick you up at your house in, say, an hour. Miss Habersham in the front seat with his uncle said, ha! That was all. She didn't curse. She didn't need to. It was far more definite and final than just cursing. She leaned forward to look past his uncle at the sheriff. Get in your car and go to the jail, or wherever you'll go to get somebody to do the digging this time. We had to fill it up again because we knew you wouldn't believe it even yet unless you saw it there yourself. Go on, she said. We'll meet you out there. Go on, she said. But the sheriff didn't move. He could hear him breathing, vast, subterranean, and deliberate, like sighing almost. Of course I don't know about you, the sheriff said. A lady without nothing but a couple thousand chickens to feed and nurse and water and a vegetable farm hardly 5 acres big to run might not have nothing to do all day. But these boys, anyway, have got to go to school. Leastways, I never heard about any rule in the school board to give holidays for digging up corpses. And that even stopped her. But she didn't sit back yet. She still leaned forward where she could look past his uncle at the sheriff, and he thought again, she's too old for this, to have to do this. Only if she hadn't, then he and Alexander, what she and his uncle and the sheriff, all three, and his mother and father, and Paralee too, would have called children, would have had to do it. Not would have done it, but would have had to do it to preserve not even justice and decency, but innocence. And he thought of man, who apparently had to kill man not for motive or reason, but simply for the sake, the need, the compulsion of having to kill man, inventing, creating his motive and reason afterward so that he could still stand up among man as a rational creature. Whoever had had to kill Vincent Gowrie had then to dig him up dead and slay another to put in his vacated grave so that whoever had to kill him could rest. And Vincent Gowrie's kin and neighbors who would have to kill Lucas or someone or anyone, it would not really matter who, so that they could lie down and breathe quiet and even grieve quiet and so rest. The sheriff's voice was mild, almost gentle even. You go home. You and these boys have done fine. Likely you saved a life. Now you go home and let us attend to the rest of it. That won't be any place for a lady out there. But Miss Habersham was just stopped, nor even that for long. It wasn't for a man either last night. Wait, Hope, his uncle said. Then his uncle turned to Miss Habersham. Your job's in town here, he said. Don't you know that? Now Miss Habersham watched his uncle. But she still hadn't sat back in the seat, giving no ground to anyone yet. Watching, It was as though she had not at all exchanged one opponent for another, but without pause or falter had accepted them both, asking no quarter, crying no odds. "Will Leggett's a farmer," his uncle said, "besides being up all night. He's got to go home and see to his own business for a little while." "How's that Mr. Hampton got other deputies?" Miss Habersham said. "What are they for?" "They're just men with guns," his uncle said. "Leggett himself told Chick and me last night that if enough men made up their minds and kept them made up, they would pass him and Mr. Tubbs both in time. But if a woman, a lady, a white lady—" His uncle stopped, ceased. They stared at each other. Watching them, he thought again of his uncle and Lucas in the cell last night. It was last night, of course. It seemed like years now. Again, except for the fact that his uncle and Miss Habersham were actually looking into each other's physical eyes instead of bending each upon the other, that absolute concentration of all the senses in the sum of which mere clumsy, fallible perception weighed little more than the ability to read Sanskrit would. He might have been watching the last two stayers in a poker pot. Just to sit there, in sight, where the first one that passes can have the word spread long before beat four can even get the truck cranked up to start to town, while we go out there and finish it for good, forever. Miss Habersham leaned slowly back until her back came against the seat. She said, "So I'm to sit there on that staircase with my skirts spread, or maybe better, with my back against the balustrade and one foot propped against the wall of Mrs. Tubbs's kitchen, while you men who never had time yesterday to ask that old nigger a few questions, and so all he had last night was a boy, a child." His uncle said nothing. The sheriff leaned above the window, breathing vast subterranean sighs. Not breathing hard, but just as a big man seems to have to breathe. Miss Habersham said, "Drive me home first. I've got some mending to do. I ain't going to sit there all morning doing nothing so that Mrs. Tubbs will think she has to talk to me. Drive me home first. I realized an hour ago what a rush and hurry you and Mr. Hampton are in, but you can spare the time for that. Alexander can bring my truck to the jail on his way to school and leave it in front of the gate." "Yes'm," his uncle said.